Here's an experiment for you. Take passionate experts in human resource technology. Invite cross-industry experts from inside and outside HR. Mix in what's happening in people analytics today. Give them the technology to connect. Hit record. Pour their discussions into a beaker. Mix thoroughly, and voila, you get the HR Data Labs podcast, where we explore the impact of data and analytics to your business. We may get passionate and even irreverent, but count on each episode challenging and enhancing your understanding of the way people data can be used to solve real-world problems. Now, here's your host, David Turetsky.
Hello and welcome to the HR Data Labs podcast. I'm your host, David Turetsky. As always, we try and find fun, fascinating people to talk to you about the world of HR, inside and outside of HR as well. Today, we get to speak to my friend, Sean Luchens from Visier. He'll give his past. He's been many places, but we're here at the HR Technology Conference. Sean, how are you?
I'm great. This is awesome. I know you just mentioned it, but there are pigeons flying throughout here. It's very interesting. It's
there
a giant indoor complex with
flying
pigeons.
In the conference. I don't think that's actually a feature. I think that's a bug.
Well, I do live out in the country a little bit, so I appreciate them bringing a little bit of that into the building for me.
Yes, rats with wings are something that we should be hoping for. So, Sean, why don't you give a little bit about your background?
So I've been in HR for 30 years, 25 years, like a long time, basically doing talent acquisition software, compensation benefit software, places like salary.com, in the past, Korn Ferry, Mercer, and now at Visier. All of it's always been around building software and working with, you know, clients and partners, and never a practitioner, because honestly, David, that looks really hard. I'd rather provide them really cool tools and let them do the work.
Yeah. Well, as a former practitioner, it really is hard. But the fascinating thing about being a practitioner and then being the solution or trying to be an innovator in it is that you think you know, but you don't from what you did, because things change. Oh. And so I don't know everything. I definitely don't know everything. And so the wonderful part about doing this work is to be able to talk to people and to be able to get their perspective on what happens now. So you're right. It is, you know, being a practitioner is hard. We're going to talk about that a little bit with our topic today. But Sean, before we get to that, what's one fun thing that no one knows about Sean?
Probably some know, but I'm definitely an avid outdoors person. So, which is interesting since I'm in Vegas. So Vegas is in my top five places to generally not visit.
Really?
It's a lot, but I love being outdoors. So basically, I would say 17-year-old in an old person's body, but 19, so that I'm legal for my wife. But love being in the outdoors. So yes. It's interesting. So kind of a dichotomy of loving the outdoors, swim, bike, run, hike, kayak, and then work on HR technology.
Well, you know, the fun thing about Vegas is that the Grand Canyon's not too far away.
Be there Saturday.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. And I actually run every morning, and I love running in Vegas because it's always nice out in the morning.
That's a fact.
And it is just, it seems like, you know, there's that one time right after the sun breaks when it's just the new day, and it just feels wonderful to run here. So. But I hear you. In fact, good luck at the Grand Canyon. It's a wonderful place to go.
Oh, I love it. I've done, so HR tech, before we go to the real work, I always have, I've booed a lot of trips here. I tell people, Vegas, jokingly, Vegas, everyone should go once. No one should have to go twice if they don't want. But outside of Vegas, you know, Zion's a couple hours, sure. Death Valley's a couple hours, the Grand Canyon, either rim is a couple hours. There's so many beautiful places to go out and around outside of Vegas. And then obviously, you know, the center of the universe for HR tech this week.
Yeah. So, Sean, let's talk about our topic for today. We're going to talk about leveraging people analytics in the compensation allocation process. And the beautiful part about that is that it's actually evolved significantly over time. Let's first start with, why has it become so difficult to allocate compensation with all of the wonderful technology that is available today?
Yeah, I think just because more, you know, we mentioned the practitioners, more is being asked of the practitioners now. So, and I know we'll go into depth of this, but at a high level, I kind of joke. At one side, they are asked to differentiate for pay for performance or a nine box or come up with some complicated way to make sure that people are being paid differently. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have to pay fairly or equally. And right. So at a high level, the practitioner is being asked to, you need to pay differently, but the same.
Right.
And so how do you actually square that out through the process? And the compensation process is a way to tackle some of those issues.
Right. But I mean, let me fundamentally disagree with one thing you just said. It's not paying the same. Pay equity is not paying the same. It's paying fairly.
Fairly.
Within yep. some guidelines so that you're paying people doing the same work at ostensibly the same level.
Correct. Which is why I think technology becomes the key part, right? So if you don't have tech to measure how you're differentiating
sure.
and document that, then you have to pay the same and you don't want to pay the same. And so now you have more tools and more things to do through the process. And I might date myself a little. You know, when 360s came out, it was kind of a thing. Yeah. You did it, you checked the box, and right. it didn't matter. Now they really matter, right? So you have to make sure everyone does their diligence, goes through, and why is David a better performer than Sean so that I can pay in a differentiated way? Because if I don't document and manage that,
yes.
then by theory, we're doing the same job on paper.
We could also argue, though, that trying to differentiate with 3% increases doesn't really help very much.
Agreed.
Well, now 3.5, maybe 4, but,
well, it depends,
but still.
Depends what you read.
Even so, and what you experience. But even so, it's just very hard to differentiate pay or differentiate based on performance when you're not dealing with a lot.
Well, but depending where we go, I think that's where there is some upside to where the tech's going now. So if you can go back and say, I'm going to lower my risk of resignation and my turnover, and I'm going to do these things because statistically, if you give me another percent, so I move from 3.5% to 4.5% or 5%, I'm going to save you 2 points. That's the math that you need to run up to the CFO with. Otherwise, you're asking the CFO for more money without a rationale, and that's hard.
Yeah, I think I've tried in the past to run past CFOs. Give me more money. I will, try and make a business case that we're going to reduce turnover and therefore reduce cost. And I got back, well, it's not a zero-sum game. You don't get that money. We have to actually keep that money. So we're increasing our margins, or at least we're steadying our margins. So I've had that happen as a practitioner, and it's a tough fight.
It is. And pulling in the analytics or whatever tool you want to use,
sure,
I guess.
Sure.
If you pull it in from across the business and stay just out of the compensation lane, but integrate that into your compensation world, the two have to get married together. Otherwise, the ROI doesn't make sense. It's just a turnover game, not
totally,
a business ROI.
Totally. And that's where I think the CFO needs to generate that aha moment for themselves. When it comes from us, from the compensation world, it's a self-serving, ask. No. But when the CFO comes up with it on their own, because they're getting that notification of, hey, that our turnover has gone down because of our increasing spend on programs like merit or other things, that's kind of natively informing them from the analytics that they trust, not from the anecdotal crap that comes out of comp that they might believe, they may not believe, but this then gives them the opportunity to actually use it as a, a really good standard for them to follow.
Correct. Yeah. And again, I think that's the technology piece and why it's got more complicated to make the business case. You've got to pull in more and more and more data from disparate systems across your company to put it all into context for the CFO.
Right.
And that's not simple. So if you imagine old school putting it in Excel, how do you get that all squared away to make that business case? Otherwise, to your point, it looks like I'm just trying to rationalize for more money for compensation.
And the CFO's become the most literate of all of the departments we deal with in terms of being able to kind of, routinize or understand at least be able to see the truth through the bullshit, pardon the expression, from looking at that data, right? They're really good at being able to sniff out crap when it comes to data. And, it doesn't matter what system you're dealing with. If there is a integral part of what they do that actually does consume those things on a regular basis, I think that does help your business case.
Well, and I think looking back, too, I think that's a fundamental flaw with a lot of organizations is they do merit. And rightly so, they say, thank goodness, that's over with. That was kind of miserable, making everybody happy.
Right, right.
They don't go back and say, well, 6-12 months later, did that actually reduce the turnover in certain roles? Did high performers actually stay? People that I gave an increase to over a certain comp ratio, did they stay or go? Like, did you go back and analyze the data to say this worked or didn't work?
Right.
Because I think CFOs appreciate that. If you ask a CFO, they're going to want trend lines. They're going to want predictive analytics based off history.
Right.
So do we produce that for them?
And I think that goes to then being able to see these things as being hypotheses that we test and then actually coming back and reporting on the research.
Correct.
To your point, that when it becomes routine, then that actually then proves or disproves your theory and then gives you evidence, right? But you need to have the numbers for that.
Yeah.
And when you're dealing with things like the compensation program, you're doing this on a not a daily basis, but on a yearly basis. And so every time you're going back to that well for trying to justify a budget, whether it's 3.5 or 4.5 or whatever, you're using a lot of data points and you're not making hypotheses. You're just saying, this is what it is, you know, deal with it. This is what the salary budget surveys say, you know. And but I like your evidence-based approach that enables you to sell a story. And I think what you're saying is make it something where you're going to tell the CFO what your hypothesis is, and then whether it's proven or not, so that you can justify a larger investment.
Yeah, and adapt and move on, you know, almost like a product. I'm a product person by trade. Sure. So basically aim, fire, right?
Right?
So every company's different. We know that. And so you go back in, you look at it and say, this worked, this didn't work. So let's do more of the stuff that worked and maybe worked in this division. And now with technology, you have that capacity to go back and say, in this group, this works. In this group, the same thing doesn't work.
Right.
Like what you hear so far? Make sure you never miss a show by clicking subscribe. This podcast is made possible by Salary.com. Now, back to the show.
You brought up before about pay equity. And one of the things I wanted to talk about is, how have you seen companies addressing pay equity in the context of being able to retain talent? Because, you know, you can try and keep diverse talent, but is there really something there where you're able to actually maintain not just the diversity, but also maintain your staff and as a whole?
Yeah, I think pay equity is, I mean, for me, it's one of the most challenging things out there because you can't fix it by today, because as soon as you hire the next person, the next person gets promoted.
Right.
It's always a moving target. And if you're only doing merit once a year, you know, you're hiring, it's moving throughout the year. You do promotions in the middle. And so how do you arm managers who aren't, you know, pay equity experts by chance? And they're trying to do their day job. So if you put yourself in their shoes, they're doing a day job. And in theory, they want the best player available to do the job. And so they don't look at pay equity. They just know that I need David on the job.
Right.
This is what David said he needs for pay. I almost don't care if it messes everything else up right now because I need David to do this job to make my number, whatever my goal is in my department. And so how do you arm them with enough information and help to help them make, you know, decisions to say, well, this is what's going to happen and, you know, down the road?
To me, that problem that you're highlighting comes down to training the manager on making sure whether it's David who needs to be supported from a pay perspective on what he says he needs, to making sure Barbara doesn't suffer because David's getting the increase that Barbara should have gotten, and that David and Barbara aren't on the same level playing field, especially given performance and education and experience and things like that.
Yeah. But I think that's the remediating it is hard, right? Highlighting it, I wouldn't say is easy, but you highlight it and there's a giant gap. And I haven't seen any companies, maybe you have, who said, well, I'm just going to go ahead and I'm going to bite the bullet this year and make pay equity and I'm going to pay it all right now and catch everybody up. Generally, what I've seen, most companies are trying to create a remediation strategy moving ahead and say, over the next couple years, while I'm doing my 3% increase, I need to catch these people up and kind of move forward. And so I think giving, you know, managers both the tools, but also kind of a forward-looking predictive analysis to say, you know, if you make this change, you're only making the problem worse, or here's how you make the problem better over time, or here's the differentiation if you don't make it. What happens if I don't give Sean an increase, even though I might want to? What's his risk to resignate or go somewhere else based on what we know in the market?
Well, it is a multivariate equation, right? And once you're trying to solve for, as you said, you're trying to solve for David or Sean and Barbara, you need to make sure that that awareness of what those puts and takes do to affect pay equity. You mentioned the plan, and the plan is very important because once you find out you have a problem and the awareness is there, it doesn't help if you're, you know, doubling down on that when you give merit increases and the 3%, even whether it's peanut butter or not, it doesn't help. But typically what I've seen is that that plan gets made with the CFO, and there is or are monies set aside for those remediations to happen over time. And then, to your point before, every subsequent pay change has to be taken into consideration in order to make sure that things are done right.
And I think that's where leverage, you know, leaning on tech and those solutions out there to say, here's my problem, here's how much it's going to take, here's how I look at it going forward, what happens, you know, with my pay philosophy to handle that.
Right.
So if you basically model my pay philosophy on a, you know, I know you say you can't differentiate, you know, 3.5%. So, you know, I'm giving 7 to the top and I'm giving 0 to the bottom.
Well, yeah, you'd have to do that. Yeah, that's right.
And you document all that, what happens and when it goes back. And did that, you know, when I talk about fixing your turnover, are you also fixing pay equity at the same time? And can you take a look back and say, what did that do? You know, so I used this right. strategy. I think it's the best strategy. I went with a 9-box strategy.
Right.
And then I realized that, you know what? That didn't work. You know, females left or females got left behind or what have you with this. So I need to go fix that.
Well, sometimes doing the right thing means that your organization has to suffer through some turnover.
Yeah.
And I think we've seen significant, I mean, in each personal situation we've dealt in, as a boss, I've seen this happen where I've had to make significant improvements in pay equity challenges where I knew that in doing that, I was going to have to lose some other staff. That had to be okay, because doing the right thing sometimes means pain. That's got to be okay.
I think that's the hard part is I fundamentally believe, I say all, maybe there's somebody who's not, most organizations want to be fair and good payers. Like I do think they want to be. Then it comes to the financial issue of, do I want to bite the bullet on the money and how do I make that happen? And to your point, is it worth me losing my best talent over this? So it becomes hard choices. I think if there was... money wasn't an issue and turnover wasn't an issue, which
yeah,
now I'm into rainbows and unicorns and pot of gold at the end. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Then I think people want to be fair payers, but then I think they just slowly fall out of the fair payer funnel as they go down and difficult decisions have to be made. And I still always come back to the manager, the line manager. He has a number that is not a human resources number. You know, generally, they've got something, they've got a business number they have to hit, and you are telling them they can't get this player. To get this goal if they do it. And that hard decision isn't so hard for HR. It is, but the line manager now has to not make his number and his bonus might be made on his number. And it gets complicated and personal very fast.
Yeah, but that's why I always say, and people who've listened to my podcast will know, that I've always kind of pronounced HR is not HR. HR is the business.
Yeah.
And if we're setting ranges or rates of pay and we're giving guidelines, we're giving managers the information to make business decisions. We're not making it for them. But we're doing it in context of being a trustee for the board and for shareholders or for the ownership of being able to manage their money fairly and accurately. And so I don't buy people blaming HR. That's bullshit.
Well,
that's just a cop-out bullshit.
I think HR
bullshit.
Can help a lot at the beginning of the year, you know, before you get the increase that comes out from the CFO. Are you communicating that up? Hey, by the way, every quarter, this is the amount of money we would need to remediate. Here's the issues. Here's what we did last time. And so I think part of the problem's always been once a year, the CFO has this dreaded period of time of which someone comes to him and says, we need money for remediation versus it's always on their mind. It's always in the back of their mind and here's the money. So when they get a 3.5% and they're like, well, here's the number, you know, they know it's not enough.
Okay. But everything you just said there are business decisions, just like managing your AR, managing your debt, managing other things. They're business decisions and that are the levers that are in the key hands of the right stakeholders, whether it's the CFO or the business owner or the manager who's making these decisions. HR is guiding them on it, and they're using data, to your point before, and analytics to be able to provide them with which is the best investment. Is it fixing a pay equity issue, or is it giving a person an increase who, you know, helps drive your business forward? Mm-hmm. I would argue that because there have been structural issues with pay over time, that a lot of the people who have now pay equity issues have not been enabled in order to be able to get that pay and to be able to make those decisions because they could have been or should have been in that same position as the person who we're talking about might be the person who's not getting that 7% increase because of this.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a very political statement, but...
Well, I think, you know, having the technology and the tools to push down your pay philosophy to fix that will help managers, because I think, again, this is something, might have been a World at Work survey, you know, 33% of managers have either never done or doing their first or second equity run through. And so it's not their core competency either. You don't hire a process manager because of their HR skills. You hire them because they're great at being a process manager.
Or the Peter principle. You grow to your highest level of... Yeah. of.
Well, and it's not your core competency in your job. And they probably don't ask, you know, I mean, I've been hired as a product manager several times, right? Sure. No one's actually asked what my HR skills are, how I am as a manager, right?
Right, right.
And so if you can push that pay philosophy down and give them some guiding principles and some information and context, they're generally smart people, right? So you give them some context to say, here's what's going to happen. Now, here's the risk of resignation if you move this up and down. Here's what happens in the next couple of years. And you give them some of those tools to push that philosophy down to help them along the way.
Right.
Again, I know you'll say some, you know, not everyone, but I said most people want to be fair payers. And I assume most managers want it to be fair payers as long as you give them the tools.
Yeah, I don't necessarily completely agree that every company wants to be. Some know their pay gap and do nothing about it. Some don't want to know what their pay gap is. And then some go to the extent of actually not only understanding their pay gap, but then learning what's the statistical significance of their pay gaps and whether or not they're ones that need to be or must be taken care of.
Fair. The ostrich method is my favorite there. That is still my favorite, as long as that's a legitimate way.
If I don't, you know, you talk to companies,
I don't want to know, because if once I know, then I have to admit I have a problem and I have to mentally choose to not to ignore it.
Right.
But if I don't know I have a problem, I didn't choose to not fix it.
Right. Hey, are you listening to this and thinking to yourself, man, I wish I could talk to David about this? Well, you're in luck. We have a special offer for listeners of the HR Data Labs podcast, a free half-hour call with me about any of the topics we cover on the podcast or whatever is on your mind. Go to salary.com/HRDL consulting to schedule your free 30-minute call today. And that kind of gets to the last question, which is what could organizations do in order to start making inroads in these extremely complex business decisions.
Yeah. Which, you know, I'll preface it with what you said earlier. There's a small budget to make it happen, and it's a pay issue, right? So fundamentally, you have to change someone's pay. I don't know about you, but I haven't heard any company say we're going to fix pay equity by reducing some people's salary to lower them.
No,
so that's not a thing.
No.
And so now you're talking about spend, and you only have 3.5%. So I think the first thing is that they go out and they build the foundation of the tools so that you can differentiate with pay. And so that you can actually go back out and say, is this a pay equity issue or is someone an underperformer, overperformer? And there's all those realms in there.
Oh, absolutely.
And have a documented pay philosophy. This is how we pay. You know, we want to pay at 57.5% of comp rate, whatever, you know, however scientific they want to be.
Right.
And we're going to use pay for performance or 9-box and then document that before you start talking about the comp allocation software and tools like that. You need to have that foundation so that you can then go make a concerted effort to put that in place and look forward. Where do you want to be? You know, if you don't know where you're going, all roads will lead you there, right?
Right.
And
so
make sure you kind of understand where you want to be and when you think you can get there.
But to me, the add-on to that is educate. Huh. Inform, give insight, give as much information as possible. You're mentioning all the great analytics you can bring to bear. It's not just about the comp ratio. It's about, as you mentioned before, what's their, you know, readiness to resign? What's their, you know, what's their flight risk, you know, if we want to go there? You know, what are other things that we can look at, you know, performance over time or other things that are the leading indicators as to, you know, how do I allocate this 3.5% or more, you know, it's 4% or whatever it is. How do I give the right decision in this really complex, crazy world?
Well, don't be afraid to be wrong. And I say that from the standpoint of if you're afraid to be wrong, you'll kind of go ostrich method and say, I did my best effort. I don't want to go back and
see. Or peanut butter method. Yeah.
Well, peanut butter's the safe way, right? Well, although actually,
no,
you know, statistically,
I would disagree.
Wrong because you make it worse, right?
Yeah.
Statistically, 3% of a bigger number is bigger than the smaller number.
Wow.
So you actually just make the problem bigger. But be willing to go back and say, we had a good thesis. We put it together.
Right.
We put it into play. Let's go back and see what happened. and then be like, okay, we were good here, we were bad here, let's just get smarter as we go and address the problem. Say the good and the bad with pay equity is you can't fix it on one given day.
No.
And so it is a long-term effort. So you have the ability to kind of aim fire as you go.
And being wrong and getting or having turnover happen isn't necessarily bad. Yes, there's some regrettable turnover and there are people we don't want to lose. But what happens when there's turnover? It brings opportunity for other people, right? And so to me, the longer tail here is, I look what you were talking about before, fail and learn and then move on.
It's a GPS, it's a pay equity GPS, recalculating.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
That road's closed, that didn't work out. And I think it's going to get complicated. You'll find some divisions or departments have, what you thought was going to work, worked. And for another set of individuals that are good at a job, it didn't work.
Yeah, that brings up flexibility, right? Mm-hmm. Giving guidelines that are flexible based on the business need of the individual area. Totally agree. There are whales loose at HR Tech.
In Vegas, by the way, which is...
Inside, where the pigeons are.
Yeah, I did not know those two cohabitated.
Only in Vegas. Sean, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Great to see you.
Great to see you too. Thank you very much. And thank you everybody for listening. Take care and stay safe.
That was the HR Data Labs podcast. If you liked the episode, please subscribe. And if you know anyone that might like to hear it, please send it their way. Thank you for joining us this week and stay tuned for our next episode. Stay safe.